a primer on pretzel logic next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Miles.
Hello, Barry. Glad to hear your tones on the radio again over the telephone line as we record this. As always, it's good to talk to you.
It is good to be talked to.
Well, since the alternative is rather unpleasant.
Chuck, I want our listeners to know that, no, we have not started a bakery. When I talk about pretzel logic at the bone coming into the programs today. But what we're talking about is a train of thinking, well, that actually defies logic, but you twist and turn and rationalize so much in order to get to what you think is a logical conclusion. There are many things we can apply this to, Charles. Obviously, we can apply it to the world of politics. We can apply it sometimes to attacks upon Christianity. We can also apply it to defenses of Christianity every once in a while.
There are some bad ones out there, believe me.
There are some bad ones out there. But what we're really going to be applying the idea of pretzel logic to is the Supreme Court decision that was issued here a few weeks back on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, specifically Chief Justice John Roberts and his majority opinion. Chuck, as our listeners know, we've talked about this a little bit in the past when the decision first came out. But since then, there has been some interesting commentary that has been offered on John Roberts' motivation for being the swing vote on the decision. And as a matter of fact, one of the articles that we're referencing today is actually Commentary Magazine Online, commentarymagazine.com, an article by Rick Richmond called How the Court Made a Bad Bill Worse. Well, I think all of us who are paying any attention whatsoever understand how they made it worse, but I thought this would be a good time for us to discuss the pretzel logic, or so it seems, of Chief Justice John Roberts.
And it is pretzel logic, Barry. There's no doubt about that. We said so at the time, and we have never come off that. Now, what's interesting is to hear the pretzel logic continued in people who are now arguing, well, the Supreme Court found it constitutional, and therefore, it's constitutional. And, of course, that's always an absurd notion in and of itself. When you can take plain and simple language of the Constitution and say that it doesn't mean what it clearly says and declare things constitutional or unconstitutional on that basis, pretzel logic applies.
Absolutely.
And we've seen so much of that, Barry. You know, for instance, people that are talking about common sense gun control. Well, the Constitution's very clear, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and what that means is that the right to regulate firearms ownership is left to the states, not to the federal government.
That's right.
And yet, the fact is that the state can restrict you from owning a tank or a bazooka or a machine gun, but the federal government can't, and yet we have federal laws that say you can't own a tank or a bazooka or a machine gun. Now, I'm not necessarily advocating the private ownership of tanks or bazookas. We could argue that someday over maybe a glass of adult beverage, but what I am arguing for is the fact that that regulatory power was left to the states, and that's because the states had militias. We won't go too far into this, but the states had militias, and very often the artillery pieces and such were owned by private individuals in the care of the town who stored them for use by the militia. Okay, well, the same logic applies to things like healthcare. If someone can point to me in the Constitution among the enumerated powers where healthcare is one of those powers, then I will happily concede the argument that Obamacare is constitutional.
No, wait a minute. Let me look. Article 1, Section 8. Okay, no, the post offices and post roads.
No. Nope.
Uniform banker. Oh, patents and cop. No, no, that isn't it either. I give up. Am I in the wrong section?
Well, guess what? You're not going to find it in any section. The closest you're going to get, and the argument that gets made, is the general welfare clause, which has absolutely nothing to do with the individual welfare, which is what healthcare mandates have to do with. The general welfare has to do with the well-being of the economy and the business picture of the individual states. And you can argue against that all you want, and the fact is that the Founding Fathers agree with me and not with you if you take that position.
There you go.
So I know that from reading the writings of the Founding Fathers, and we would happily teach you these things in our Institute on the Constitution class, where we teach constitutional principles in a 12-week course. And unfortunately, John Roberts needs to take our class.
Yeah, well, maybe if we can get some underwriters, they can send us to D.C. for 12 weeks, and we could sit down and do an IOTC for the court.
Barry, I don't think I could take 3 months in Washington, D.C.
I'm not sure I could either, but if we had to do it in the cause of getting our court to understand the Constitution, I'd be willing to sacrifice, Chuck.
Sacrifices must be made. Maybe we can come home when the days we're not teaching. But that being said, what we're talking about today is John Roberts essentially rewriting the law that the Congress passed, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which in fact he did rewrite it because what he did was he took the mandate that required the purchase of health care insurance and twisted it around on its head and said, no, you don't have to buy it. You can take the option of paying a penalty instead. Now, okay, you'll pardon me for saying so. But
the first loop of our pretzel.
Yes, the first loop. Well, yeah. The second loop is the fact that forcing me to pay a fee so that I can have health care, you have just forced me to buy it.
That's right. That's right, because when you penalize somebody for not taking an action, what you're trying to do, in essence, is force them to take the action to make the penalty more onerous than actually conforming to the requirement.
Yeah, here's what it's saying. Buy it or we will give it to you and then penalize you for it. In other words, buy it or we'll force you to buy it. It's six and one half dozen of another. It's taking your wallet out of your right-hand pocket and putting it in your left. This really is truly, Barry, this is the kind of legal... I've used the phrase before that lawyers are word tamers.
Uh-huh.
They make words do things that they don't normally do.
Yes.
This is one of those places.
But, Chuck, here's a thought. If you require somebody to buy insurance, then it's not a tax, right?
Unless it's the government.
But if then they have a choice between paying a penalty, which is a tax, or buying the insurance, it then makes the purchase of the insurance a tax, doesn't it?
It does in my book, because the IRS is in charge of making sure this is all taken care of. So why would you put... Yeah, it has to do with the Internal Revenue of the United States of America. That makes it a tax.
So therefore, there's the second loop of our precedent there.
And this is just simply amazing, Barry, because I'm looking through my Constitution again, and I go to Article 3, which has to do with the courts, and I see no power to rewrite laws.
Really? Are you sure that doesn't emanate from the shadows of the penumbras of the Constitution?
Yeah, sort of like abortion.
Yeah, the right to kill your defenseless unborn child. Yes. Yeah. So Potter Stewart is living large through John Roberts. He must be channeling him.
Yes, that's right. But you know, here's one of the major issues. I'm sort of dumbfounded by some liberal law professors. Here's a quote from a different article that's quoted in this article by Tevi Troy in the Obamacare debacle deepens that came out right after this decision. And it says, quite simply, the Roberts opinion took a bad bill and made it worse. If Obamacare continues to exist in the form Roberts has devised, with much of the mechanism for funding its requirements stripped out, the consequences for the country and for our healthcare system may be even more disastrous than they would have been had the problematic law simply been allowed to stand as it was. Well, I don't think so, Barry, because either way, it's a despotic intrusion into the personal relationship you have with your doctor and with the hospital you choose. But the next line is very telling, and this is written by Rick Richmond as he analyzes that last line. He says, but at least the Chief Justice preserved the reputation of the court from criticism for judicial activism. What a former University of Chicago Law School lecturer alleged would have been, quote, an unprecedented extraordinary step, unquote, if it were to, quote, somehow overturn a duly constituted and passed law. Barry, there's another twist in the pretzel.
Yeah, well, this is it's becoming a Gordian knot pretzel that we're baking here today, or that John Roberts is baking. And Chuck, honestly, I have to take a little bit of umbrage with the previous quote from Mr.
Troy.
Richmond.
Oh,
no,
Richmond.
For Mr. Richmond, basically saying that the Chief Justice preserved the reputation of the court from criticism for judicial activism. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've just said the court basically rewrote the law in order to somehow shoehorn it in and call it constitutional. If that's not judicial activism, Chuck, I don't know what is.
And to give Richmond maybe given the benefit of the doubt and say that perhaps he was being facetious?
Well, possibly.
Because I don't think from the tone of this article that he really thinks that Roberts didn't engage in judicial activism. In fact, the whole point of the article is that the entire court did engage in judicial activism by playing this game that a penalty isn't a tax. Well, of course it's a tax.
Of course it is.
That's an absurdity. And what will happen is, I'll be quite honest with you, Barry, I don't see how the number of people who will start off on the system this way, who will be paying the fine, can possibly cover the costs that are going to arise from covering things that, for instance, pre-existing conditions like somebody who gets a brain tumor and has to have multiple tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in treatments and is only paying X number of dollars into the system. More and more and more of us are going to have to kick in for that because, let's face it, those costs cannot be covered by the simple fines of those who refuse to buy the healthcare insurance. The numbers just aren't there, and eventually it is going to have to turn into a direct tax. There's no way around that. Richmond here talks about the fear of such criticism may have been exaggerated, a criticism of the court. The same week that the court upheld Obamacare, it overturned a total of 32 out of 33 state and federal statutes, every one of them the duly constituted and passed law, in what? Order to zing the University of Chicago professor.
Well, and honestly, Chuck, I got umbrage with that one too. Not with Richmond's comment, but with that University of Chicago professor making the statement, which is a little brash, I think, that Obamacare was actually a duly constituted and passed law.
Oh, right.
It was passed by the appropriate margins. But the question of duly constituted is very, very pregnant in this because if there's no power in the Constitution for Congress to regulate and legislate on health care, then the bill could not have been duly constituted.
And that's a good point. The Congress tomorrow could pass a bill that says all people that are under, all adults over the age of 21 who are under the height of 4'8" must turn themselves in for incarceration or execution in order to protect the height of the population. Well, that's not a constitutional bill.
That's right. That's exactly my point, is we have to be careful, and this is, ladies and gentlemen, this is the reason why Chuck and I do these analyses for you, is to help you to understand, not just to read something and just say, oh, okay, and keep going with it, but to stop and think about it. If Obamacare were a duly constituted bill, it would not have come from the federal level at all. It would have come from the state level. And even then, it would have been questionable. But the point is that now we make the assumption, the statement gets thrown out there by this law school lecturer that this was a duly constituted and passed law. Everybody's supposed to accede to that. And unfortunately, Richmond does do that by saying that 32 out of 33 other statutes that the court overturned was a duly constituted and passed law. So in other words, he's carrying that meme that the Obamacare bill was legitimate to start with.
Okay, Barry, we're going to run a little short on time, but I'm just going to make a quick comment, and that is that this is what the difference between constitutionalism and conservatism. Because a conservative looks at something like this and says, well, we can preserve this part of it and this part of it and this part of it, but to be reasonable, we need to throw this part out. And the constitutionalist, and I will agree, it's an extreme position because it says there is no middle ground. The whole thing is out because the whole thing completely avoids and violates the tenets of the Constitution. And the conservative looks at it and says, well, we've done it this way here, 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 and here for this many years, and therefore, it's really okay to do that. That is the vast difference between constitutionalism and conservatism, and it's why I think I call myself a constitutionalist, and I think you do too.
Yeah,
I'll let you speak for yourself.
Well, all I can say is, what was so extreme about that example you just gave?
Yeah, exactly.
So, yes, I would consider myself a constitutionalist more than a conservative. And, ladies and gentlemen, there's not saying that they're not compatible with each other, but saying that it's like the difference between a finely tuned sports car and an AMC Gremlin.
Well, that's a good point. Having driven a Gremlin and a finely tuned sports car, I can tell you there is a world of difference between those two.
There's a world difference. They both can get you where you want to go. It's just a question of how you get there.
That's it. And how you feel when you get there.
How you feel when you get there.
With that, we're out of time. Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.